mission. With extreme prejudice, I try to terminate our mission. This is Radio Class. Consider your position.
CITR 101.9 FM. That was The Clash with Radio Clash. And I guess this is Radio Inksta. Colin's looking at me dumbfoundingly disturbed with what I just said. Inksta, it's a radio show about comics broadcasted out of CITR 101.9 FM. It is a gross, gross Thursday afternoon. The roads are covered in just gook. It's just like, I don't know. It's just disgusting out there. It's just filthy.
It's weird when the snow comes down, but it just melts on contact with the ground.
It's too warm for snow, but it's snowing, so.
Yeah.
C'est la vie. Today our guest is Frank Santoro. His latest book is Storyville, as well as a bunch of other things, and I'm going to bring Frank on. We got you there, Frank.
Hello, is that you, Robin?
Yes, indeed. I should have mentioned I'm joined by my good friend Colin Upton.
Hello.
Hello, Colin.
We had some momentary song issues, or not song issues, phone issues, but we've corrected them. So I would have had more time to tell you, but it's all good now. Your latest book, Storyville, is not your latest book. It's one of your oldest books, I guess.
It is. It's really my first book, but I wanted to mention it's rainy and gross here in the Rust Belt of Pennsylvania. So.
Colin was asking where you're from, and that's what I thought.
I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but I haven't lived here in about 17 years. You know, a visit or something, but, you know, for summers or so, but I haven't lived here since I graduated high school, so it's been pretty nice to be back.
You're mainly a New Yorker guy.
I was actually in the Bay Area for about 10 years.
Oh, okay.
And then, so I kind of understand the wintry, the rainy, wintry, the life that... I've never been to Vancouver, but, you know,
it's pretty mild up here. You know. We see snow, and then we see it go.
Yeah.
It comes down for a minute, and then it's gone. So maybe let's start out with just going by a little biographical information about who Frank Santoro is and kind of what got you into comics. Because Storyville, really kind of ahead of its time as far as, like, what you're doing with the comics. I guess it's kind of from the same blood of, like, some of the stuff Mazzucchelli was doing and things.
Yeah, that was, you know, Mazzucchelli was a big deal for me because I was the right age. And I had a chance to speak with him about this, and he's actually said, like, that you were the perfect age for, you know, to follow me from Daredevil to Rubber Blanket.
Yeah.
Because I was. It was perfect. I was, you know, 18 or something when Rubber Blanket, you know, came out.
Yeah.
It was great, you know. But yeah, I mean, definitely, like, there was a lot of stuff. But there was a really great, there still is a really great comic book store here in Pittsburgh that's run by a gentleman named Bill Boyshell. And when I was, you know, I always read comics when I was a kid, and I had a great collection. There was a great store here. But then when this other store moved into town in my neighborhood, near my neighborhood, he just has the greatest comic sense. And his store was actually named after a Gilbert Hernandez story called Bem. So, I mean, it was just like, Bem, you know, Love and Rockets posters were on the walls. So when I was 15, like, I was exposed to all this great stuff. I mean, he had, like, long boxes that were just, like, the Steranko section, you know, the Jeffrey Jones section, you know, and just, it was a crazy, I mean, that was, and there was couches, you could just hang out, you didn't have to buy anything. It was, like, first place I saw Videodrome, like, all kinds of crazy movies. He would just play movies, you know, but it was a great store. So I just had a really, you know, interesting, I don't know, chance
Tootleage.
To get this different take on comics when I was a certain age, so.
And you were, from what I can gather from your writing, you grew up as a superhero boy.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I read everything. Like, you know, that was... But that, you know, and it just seemed really... You know, I read Spider-Man. I really loved all the Miller Daredevils were coming out when I was a kid. And my, you know, my grandfather had a corner store. Like, you know, it was like a grocery / lottery place where you got your lottery tickets and stuff like that. So, you know, my job after school was to, like, wait on the kids, like, buying candy and comics. And so I got to have whatever comics I wanted. So there was, like, Mike Zeck, Captain America's when I was a kid or whatever, and I read all that stuff. And, you know, John Byrne, Fantastic Fours, whatever there was. But then when it moved into Dark Knight and things, I was, again, the perfect age. I was, like, 13, 14, you know, when Dark Knight and Watchmen came out. Mm-hmm. So I read all that, and then just my taste changed, and it was just this kind of comics renaissance that I was, like, growing up, you know, in. And
yeah,
it was really exciting, actually. You know, so.
Many good things have changed from the old days of
yeah,
cheesy fromage of comics.
Sure.
But then it's gone back to that recently. But
so, like,
I
all
digress.
That stuff was just kind of in the air. You know, it was just, like, reading. You know, that's why I still try to, you know, either write about or think about now is, like, you know, what I'm doing or what's going on in kind of alternative avant-garde comics and what's really happening in the mainstream of comics and stuff. And just because it seemed back then, everybody, we just read everything, you know. It wasn't as kind of, you know, I read this and I didn't read that or something. So.
Well, there wasn't as wide a selection as what we're dealing with nowadays.
Very true.
Well, were you aware of things like the Comics Journal?
For sure. You know, I read the Journal. We, you know... just everything, you know. I was aware of the Journal. You know, Dan Clowes came to town early on when he was, I think, when 8-Ball first came out. The Hernandez brothers came to town in '91. My friend brought them to do a con here. It was really great. So, you know, it was just very, you know, it was like a, I don't know. We were just really. I mean, we didn't think much. I mean, we didn't think we were, like, special or something. It was just that's what it was. You know. So.
Well, I
was totally aware of all this.
I just remember, like, being one of those people who read the Comics Journal, and that sort of built up this kind of feeling of sort of comic geek elitism.
Right. Well, the best is when Storyville got reviewed by the Journal. My friends who don't read a lot of Fantagraphics or alternative stuff, they're like, "Now you know you suck because the Journal reviewed you."
Oh, now Storyville. What do you have in mind when you first did it?
Storyville really was like this. You know, I had been doing these crime comics, and
these were the Circ.
The Circ zines, and then I was doing these mini cup. Like, you know, it was the Bay Area. I was living just to give you know. So I was living in San Francisco. I dropped out of art school, and I was just living in San Francisco in the early 90s, like 90, 91, 92, and, you know, something that was a huge influence on me was Comet Bus, and Comet Bus was a zine by a guy named Aaron, and it was a Bay Area thing, and everybody read Comet Bus. This was like, it was like the internet for the Bay Area or something. It was a really great, like, political zine, music zine, writing. It's just, he was just able to do everything, and so I just saw these different zines, and I was interested in, you know, that's what I wanted to make instead of making paintings or sculptures in art school, and I just chose to make zines as like that was what I was going to do, you know, and there were no color zines, and I just, you know, there was just things came together, and I was making these crime comics, and then that turned into, like, this idea of trying to do more narrative stuff than maybe what I had started doing, and I got really into Ben Catcher, and I got really into Captain Easy and Roy Crane, and just all that stuff kind of came together. And I mean, I was really young. I was 20, 21, 22, so I was just trying to figure out how I wanted to tell stories or write a story or something. So,
what was your interest in being so anonymous with it? Because in the hardcover, it mentions how you went by the moniker Circ.
I really, like, it was really a couple things. Like, Bill Boychel, again, at BEM, the comic book store where I hung out, he made these zines himself that were just on the Xerox machine, and he didn't sign them. It was just a BEM publication. And they were just these crazy, like, abstract comics, and he never signed them. And he kind of had these different voices, and everyone was a different title. And that's what I did with the Circ thing. Everyone was a different title, and I just wanted to be able to switch styles in between magazines and not be pinned down to one thing. And then that was compounded with, like, I would go into Comic Relief in San Francisco to sell my zines, and then I just felt really nervous. I didn't want to get rejected, and so I would be like, I work for this thing, you know, Circ Productions. I work for Circ Productions. Do you want to buy some zines? You know, yes, this guy, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'd make up a story about, you know, or something. So it was just kind of this, you know, desire to just be in the background and let the work speak and watch people's reaction. I could see people, I love this stuff, you know, or something. And it just felt like easier way of getting out there and, you know, testing the waters. And it worked. And then the same with Storyville. Like, I was just a kid. I was just putting it out myself. I didn't really want to be, like, beating my chest. I wanted it to be about the work as you know, maybe corny as that sounds, you know. I really just, that's what I wanted. And I wasn't actually even going to put a return address on it. I mean, to be honest, you know. And there was a lot of that was like Bobby Madness, this, you know, like you could call him a punk cartoonist, like Bobby Madness, Aaron Comet Bus. There were a lot of zines and papers in the Bay Area that were never signed. And you sort of, you know, didn't know who did them even though you knew who did them or something. Mm-hmm. So
if you knew, you knew. Now, Storyville, actually, I'm going to talk about Circ a little more because I'm looking at these great covers. How did you print them?
There was a regular Xerox machine that was introduced in the early 90s that you could take out the toner cartridge of black and put in a red cartridge or a green or a blue or a brown. And there were stores in San Francisco that had them, and I found out about them through a friend, and then I just realized, like, I could just make stuff like this, just like a silkscreen or an offset. I could just make them on Xerox, and it was a lot, like, kind of less pretentious than a silkscreen comic or something. You know, I like the feel of it better.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because looks like silkscreen and stuff.
It's not. It's on regular typing paper. It's just it's like a zine, but it's just in two colors.
Totally.
Yeah, three colors.
You just do one copy and then go to the other machine and do the other layer.
Yeah, and I would do an addition of, like, you know, 200 or something, as many as I could. And a lot of times I was, like, you know, like, literally, you know, I was walking away out of the copy store with them. You know, I was just trying, doing my best to just figure out how I could afford doing it, you know. It was just a, trying to get by and put stuff out and then sell it at Comic Relief or something, you know. But then that was expensive, you know, even if I was able to get away with a few copies. And then that was how, the you know, I started, actually was working for, you know, the poster artist Frank Kozik, who did a lot of, like, rock and roll posters and stuff in the 90s and, you know, covers for bands. I was working for him. He was a silkscreen artist, and he had a studio right beneath Last Gasp in south of Market, San Francisco. And I was working for him, and he, you know, we started talking about, like, different ways of printing stuff, and he suggested the newsprint idea, actually. So that was kind of, like, there was just that was sort of just in the air, you know, back then. Like, you know, just do a newspaper. There was this one called Matt Stromberg put out called Filth that's mentioned in Storyville. And there was a free paper called, I can't remember. Oh, no, that Filth was the free paper, and then Matt's book was San Francisco, which was awesome.
All this stuff I miss living in Vancouver.
Oh, right.
I'm out of this international loop. So Storyville, this is your first shot at doing, like, a really narrative story then?
Kind of, yeah. Just, you know, aside from some other small mini-comics or something, it was really, like, my first extended story. Yeah.
Now, my big question after reading it is, it's the story of the guy going from, I think it's from Pittsburgh up to Montreal to find this other guy. Why go through Winnipeg?
Well, when I read about the train lines back then, there was no direct train that went up the East Coast, and I wanted to be historically accurate, and he had to go west.
Okay, I was wondering. Colin's...
There was really like there was a problem with the train line, and especially for vagrants, it wasn't possible from what I had read, and so I'd found this book by a former tramp, and that was, like, his part of his diary and stuff. Was he was able to, like, you know, discern this stuff through, like, these little hobo signs that were left on train doors and things like that, you know.
So, like, that episode of The Simpsons?
Which I spelled wrong in the book. I'm so disappointed. You know, the printer that prints Cold Heat in Winnipeg noticed it and was like, "You spelled Winnipeg wrong."
Did you do a lot of research into hobo culture?
I did, actually. It was there's a great book called Really the Blues by Mez Mesro, and he was, like, Louis Armstrong's best friend back in the 20s and 30s. He was from Chicago, and, you know, there was a lot of this stuff, like, where jazz musicians were out of work in the Depression, and then they ended up, like, riding the rails between Chicago and Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh had a big jazz scene, and you know, just that kind of stuff. So that stuff was there, and then, you know, like the Wobblies, and you know, I was just interested in that culture. And but especially, I got this book of, like, hobo hieroglyphics, and I read this book by, it was like, he was like the nice hobo or something. He wasn't like a criminal or something. But there were these other things that I had read that were along the lines of, you know, like a criminal gone straight and telling his story, and a lot of crime magazines, you know, focused on stories like that. So really, Storyville, you know, it is naively written, as Chris Ware points out sort of in the introduction. It's like, you know, I mean, it was just a hook. It's like a way of getting the reader into the story and then telling the story about two characters. It's not necessarily, like, I didn't set out to do a crime story, you know, when I wanted to do it. It was like, I was watching a lot of film noir. There was lots of great movie theaters in San Francisco, and I was able to, you know, it was just a way of using the story. And halfway through, like, right at the middle point where Rudy, the character Rudy, is introduced, it splits. It's like it's a different point of view. It's a different story, because I just wanted to switch it over into the, I don't know, the humanistic side of it or something, you know.
But you must have done a lot of visual research for the referencing.
I did for Montreal. For Pittsburgh was just my, you know, that's what it looks like. You know, I just drew it from life and from memory. And for the, you know, for the stuff in, like, the Midwest, I can kind of fake that. And then Montreal, I did, there was a book of, you know, some early photographs and stuff of the docks and things like that. So I wanted to be accurate, but I would always draw those drawings from the photographs, and then I would put the book of photographs away, and I would draw from my drawings. Like, I always wanted to maintain a distance between any photo referencing or something, which mm-hmm. I still do today. Like, I just really despise, you know, photo referencing in comics.
Did you use a marker?
Sometimes on my separations and things, yeah. Like, the colors that are built in cold heat. Or, well, in Storyville, yeah, there was a lot of markers and things. But that the whole black line was half-toned. So you would get these different, there would be a gray overprinting a yellow, and you would get, you know, between the three colors that are in Storyville, there's probably, you know, 18 colors or so that mm-hmm. I can get with the different tonalities and things.
So did you, your art school days, what kind of focus did you have when you were there?
I was kind of like this. You know, I went to an arts high school, and then I got a scholarship to a really conceptual art school in San Francisco, and I just kind of wasn't my cup of tea after a while, and I just felt that it was more interesting to kind of make comics as a artist statement than it was to make, you know, to do painting and sculpture and video and things, which is what I had been doing through high school and in my first year of college or whatever before I dropped out. So, you know, I liked it. Like, at the same time that I was going to school in San Francisco, it was, like, Barry McGee. He was around, and, like, there were a lot of graffiti guys. There was a lot of, like, a different vibe in the Bay Area about what was art and kind of what's flowering now in terms of paper rad and kind of this alternative art scene within the art scene is, like, that was happening a lot in the Bay Area then. You could feel it. So it felt like, you know, painting or sculpture or video is kind of old hat. In a way, and so comics felt fresh. You know, the zine, I don't know if you guys remember, but like, you know, zines, like, it was just really just like that was. It just seemed really natural, you know, in the early '90s to be doing that kind of stuff. Like, it was like this intersection of things, at least in the Bay Area. You know,
Colin's right from that school of,
yeah,
I guess Tootlian.
Very similar experience in Vancouver.
Oh, that's cool. You know, I wanted to ask you guys because of some of the stuff that I really like in Canadian comics is like. Wait, I have one here. What is it? Like, Regal Beast and Michael... How do you pronounce his name?
Michelle, you know? Rabagliati?
No, Michael Comso?
I don't...
Michael Pomo? No.
Probably a Montreal person. I'm not
too... Oh, maybe. I don't know. I met a few guys at TCAF that were just like Peter Thompson I met at TCAF mm-hmm. finally, and I just was able to get a few things from there that I just felt like were just some of the same kind of, we were talking about the same things in terms of the zines, the early 90s. And it mm-hmm. seems like that's flowering now again, and it's pretty nice to see. You know?
Well, the zine scene in Canada was very regional. So people that were doing zines in Toronto or Montreal might not be familiar with what was going on in Vancouver and vice versa.
I see, yeah. Well, talking to Mark Bell was interesting because like he was telling Mark Connery stories, who I got to meet in Toronto, and that was really interesting because it just, we don't have that kind of scene in the States, it seems, and like it just felt like it was nice to see. It was like a different kind of parallel universe that I wasn't really aware of, so the regional aspect of it seems pretty interesting to
mm-hmm.
me.
Like, I'd say Vancouver, you'll find a lot more crossover with Seattle than the rest of Canada,
especially
like the proximity. Seattle's about a 3-hour
drive. Because it's like this, it's like the stuff that I'm talking about in the Bay Area, like people who were in the Bay Area at the time, like, you know, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But then for, you know, if you missed it, it's just, it was before the internet, really. Like mm-hmm. these were just the things that we traded and were around, you know. So.
Well, so much of it depended on the mail.
Right.
If you weren't actually living in the city.
Right.
The Fact Sheet 5 days, Colin?
Fact Sheet 5, Comics FX. Days.
I think I can take a quick musical break. Which track would you like to hear, Frank?
I mean, if let's see, the Iggy song is good, but that would be cool. But the Dimension 7 is really about is the Cold Heat reference, so maybe we could do that.
Yeah, let's we'll play that and then we'll jump into the Cold Heat world.
Cool, sounds great.
Okay, so everyone, stay tuned. Inkstead, CITR 101.9. This is the Wipers, Dimension 7. Please stand by.
Straight as an arrow. not so straight. Reject, reject. Twas antisocial. Dull, dull, so dull. Standing on the stairs, cold, cold morning. Ghostly image of fear. Mayday, mayday. Gonna leave this region. They'll take me with them. Dimension 7. Dimension 7.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is Inkstead's radio show about comics. Our guest today is Frank Santoro. We're just chatting about Storyville, and we're about to jump into Cold Heat. Just to let you guys, all the listeners, know what's coming up on the Inksteads. Next week, local boy Jonathan Dalton will be joining us. He's got something coming out in anthology, and really, I got to remember what it was. This Saturday is the monthly Vancouver Comic Jam. It'll be at the Clubhouse Sushi restaurant. I don't know where.
It's Japanese food.
It's Japanese food. The food's not very good, but they have beer.
And they have a room in the back upstairs where cartoonists can play with a big table.
What they play, who knows. I'll be there. And on the 27th, we'll be doing our annual Stuff We've Liked show. January 3rd, Joe Matt will be our guest. I'm actually going to be interviewing him later today. And January 10th, Jonathan Bennett, which I'm very excited about. So, Frank, how you doing?
Good. That sounds great. You guys like go the monthly Vancouver jam. That sounds awesome.
It is. It's lots of fun. We get together and do horribly inappropriate comics.
And right. Is Mark living in Vancouver still, or
on and off?
Yeah,
he is.
I saw him in San Diego.
Yeah, he's in. I think he's in the East right now. But he actually, on the note of Mark Bell, he will be in the Inkstead's Art Show, which opens January 18th. I got to keep plugging it.
Talk about a talented mofo.
Oh, I know. And who, in the most recent Comics Comics Mag, of which you have your wonderful article about Kevin Nolan,
right, his
coloring work, has a nice big old huge Mark Bell piece.
So, it's very nice.
It's very nice.
The crazy thing about Mark is that he can just crank that, you know, like, he can just do that first take and it's done and it's beautiful and it's...
I know. You watch him do it and he just draws right. It away.
We would take requests for him at San Diego because people would come up to the table and he got sick of waiting around. You know, nobody would come up to the table and, like, get a sketch when he had a signing, so he'd, like, go have a smoke break and we'd have to, like, take orders, like, oh, wait, give us your cell phone number. Well, he'll call you when he gets back. But it worked, and he, like, did a couple sketches and, like, was able to sell a few, you know, but it was just funny. San Diego was such a madhouse, but Mark, you know, like, soldiered through it. It was awesome.
I couldn't imagine going down to that. I don't know.
Have you ever been?
No.
Oh, man. I hadn't been since the late, you know, like, 98, and I went this year with Picture Box, and it was insane. It was so just over-the-top insane. There was a life-size Jabba the Hutt.
Ew.
Yeah, exactly. But it was just insane, you know. It's such a spectacle, you know.
I stopped going to San Diego sometime in the late 90s, but I'd go to Ape instead.
Yeah, I miss Ape, actually, because that was always, like, just down the street.
Well, isn't not it much in community. San Francisco anymore?
Yeah, I left
San Francisco in... Oh. In is that what you ask? I left San Francisco in the late 90s.
And oh.
He was what? Just confused for a second.
Right.
So your latest book, Cold Heat, 4 issues out, and you guys stopped putting out the separate issues in favor of a eventual collected edition, I guess. It's the best
bummer.
Bummer. I went and bought these comics, and now I've just got to go and buy it again.
Thank you to all the subscribers and everybody who's bought the issues. Thank you, thank you. I mean, I'll make it up to you with the rest of the material. And I mean, it's just, I'm bummed out about it. It was just an economic, there's nothing we could do about it. We just, the budget that we had for it, you know, Dan really, he tried so hard, you know, and we tried so hard, and we were getting great reviews and stuff, but the numbers, Diamond is just the devil.
You know what?
They're not making it easier for the smaller publishers, are they?
No, there's a cutoff now. It's like, if you don't sell 600 copies an issue or whatever, you're done. It's over.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, if people say, so what, Diamond this, Diamond that, so what, it's not so what. It's the only way to get into comic stores, and there's a lot of people who, you know, if you got into the comic stores, they'd check it out. So it's like, I mean, you know.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, one of our local we've got two good comic stores in Vancouver. One of them only gets stuff from Diamond. And,
right.
Oh, Colin's saying there's three. Okay, find the comic shop, too. But this other one mainly gets the stuff from Last Gasp. And distributors like that, which makes me happy, and actually directly orders from Picturebox too.
Right, right. Lucky's. I mean, it's great. Yeah, there's a lot of. I mean, it's changing, but it's still.
Yeah,
you know.
There's most of the comic stores will just deal with Diamond because it's easy, and it's like
right. And who can blame them? I mean, you know, you can't really blame them, but then it's just murder for the small. It's for the small publishers. It's murder. But you know, like when I did Storyville, I sold 1,000 copies without even trying. There were three distributors back then. There was Capital. There was I think Bud Plant. It doesn't matter. Anyway, it was really easy to make alternative comics up until about 98, and then it was over. You know? And it's just gotten worse.
I found my copy of Storyville in a comic shop, the newspaper one.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's exciting when I hear people like actually did have it back in the day. It makes me really happy.
Yeah, Colin's got his here right in front of him.
All right.
He's always got a show off in front of me.
Nice.
We interviewed, just been around longer, that's all.
We interviewed Pete Bagg, and he brought in his copies of Comical Funnies.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like,
wow. That's awesome.
I actually did manage to get one of those, though, so I'm happy. So, Cold Heat.
Cold Heat.
Drawn by you, written by Ben Jones.
Of Paper Red.
Of Paper Red fame, I was going to say. So what did you guys have in mind? What was the nucleus of Let's Make Cold Heat?
It was like... You know, I think for Ben, it was just this old thing that was kicking around, and for me, it was some old, you know, images that had been kicking around, and there was just this, I don't know, we just had some really casual conversations about it, really just emails and stuff. We had hung out at SBX 2005 that year, and then I had this. Dan and I had been talking about maybe doing like a like something where Ben would write stuff for other people, and Ben and I were kicking some ideas around, but it wasn't really anything solid. And then when Dan and I suggested these other people that maybe Ben would draw stuff for, or I mean write stuff for, Ben said, "Nah, he just said to me, like, Frank, let's just you and I do something." And I was like, "Cool, all right, sounds great." And we just kicked around a few ideas, but it was really, you know, Ben just delivered the first issue after, like, this vague concept that we had, you know, whatever, and Ben just, you know, just hammered it out, and it was crazy. You know, so within, you know, a month of just this, let's just talking about it, we were on this schedule, and it started to happen, and then we put it out, and then it was happening, and I remember when we got the first issue back from the printer, Dan, like put his head back and laughed and said, "It's the most retarded thing I've ever seen in my life." So, I mean, it really was that, and it was just like, it worked. It was, holy shit, it worked. Oh, sorry.
Ah, we're in Canada.
Okay, great.
Listener discretion be advised.
But it was like, it worked. You know? Oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, so we just ran with it. And Ben laughed. Like, I mean, the message from Ben when he got the first issue was so encouraging. You know, we knew what we were going to do, but we didn't know we could pull it off. And then each issue was just pulling it off. And
what is it you're trying to pull off on us?
Just this kind of, like, take on, I mean, not like, everyone's like, oh, it's this take on a genre or something. And I don't know if that's what it is. It's just more like, for us, it's realer. It's you know, I mean, this is America. Like, I mean, the crap that we had to, like, sift through as kids, you know, it's like, it's just atrocious, you know. And, like, it's part of me. It's part of us. And, like, I feel like I'm just getting through all of my influences and everything. And I think Ben is, too. It's just like we're, like, would that be the word? Like, we're just getting
exercising,
rid of this stuff inside of us, you know?
Well, that's something with Paper Rat. It's, like, very much obvious. He's, like, they're going through the whole milieu of, I guess, you know, 80s retard chic.
Totally. But it's real. And that's what people don't get. The copycats don't get how real it is, you know, and how much it connects to people. Like, it's just weird. He's just really, they're just tapping into this larger consciousness. And as corny as that sounds, it's true. Like, the people flip out over Paper Rat who don't read comics, who, like, come up to the table at Picture Box and are just, like, bananas over Paper Rat. It does something. Like, it just goes over these boundaries. And so, like, whether you like it or not, whether it's your cup of tea or not, it's a formidable force, you know. So, I don't know.
And, so, is Cold Heat, like, kind of you and Ben taking, like, 90s culture and, like, I don't know, compressing it, putting it through a machine?
I wish it was just that clear. It's not. It's, I mean, I'm just going through all my influences. Like, I'm really trying to do something that, like, scares me. And, like, I mean, like, Cold Heat's funny, but it's scary. And, like, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it's like Twin Peaks or David Lynchian or something, but there's sometimes the best things that are terrifying or scary or a little funny too. And like, for me, it's all that stuff. It's not campy. It's not like, it's a sincere statement. It's like, and you know, people used to make fun of me about that for Storyville too. It was like, it was, you know, it was too sincere or something, you know. And like, so I think our take on this Cold Heat thing, like, whatever it is, like, Ben's humor is sincere, but it's like, it just it takes the edge off of, you know, the, I don't know, either what we're referencing or what we're trying to do, and I think it makes it new, you know. So,
well, it's kind of,
I can't really explain it, but, you know, like, for me, it works. It's like, it feels very contemporary, and like, what you know, it's like, Storyville is cool, but it's like this old-timey thing, and, you know, I just, it's really fun to be doing something that's of today, and like, that's happening now, and feels like right for now.
And you just kind of feel like there's like a seed of something that's kind of left over that needs to be, I don't know, regurgitated? I don't know if that's
maybe
the right terminology.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you know, I hope people like it. But it's not really like, I'm not trying, you know, we're not trying to, like, really please people. We're just trying to do our thing. And if you like it, great. If you don't,
well,
okay.
It's, I'm going to be honest, it's a comic that there's like a dialectical thing with it. You either love it or you just like look at it and go, what the fuck?
Sure, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, there's plenty of people have been, like, straight up with me, like, it's not my cup, yeah, I don't really like it. I'm like, that's cool, you know, that's cool, you know.
But I guess that's something you guys are going for, is just being, doing the story they want to be honest with.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fun, it's fun. And, like, comics, to me, are fun, and, like, should be, can be fun, and shouldn't, I don't have to be fun, but, you know, it's like, there's so much of comics that is, like, it's not superheroes or whatever, but it's this kind of vibe, and I want to do that. Like, I want to, part of my repertoire, I want to be able to do that. You know, I don't necessarily want to just be, like, the guy who does Storyville, and everything I do is about, like, freight cars and hobos and shit. Oh, sorry.
It's okay, I already swore, too. Now, the artwork, it's a lot of influence, I guess. Tezuka was a big influence for a lot of the face
totally.
Work in this.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, unconsciously, like, really from, like, you know, like, absorbing, like, this distillation of Tezuka through cartoons and Speed Racer and whatever, you know, like, I wasn't, like, those Tezuka books that are out now weren't out when I started doing Cold Heat. And I remember when I did the first issue of Cold Heat and I showed it to Dan, he goes, oh, my God, Tezuka, look at that. And I laughed and I thought, like, I guess you're right, but it was so unconscious. You know?
Is that something you kind of, for later issues? Because it does develop, the faces develop, I think, a little more as it goes along. You kind of, like, kind of.
Yeah, I wish I could, I can't, I'm just not capable. I'm not, like, a cartoonist. I'm not capable of doing it the same each time. Like, I can't, you know, I could, but it seems kind of boring.
Actually, what came to my mind looking at it was Frank Stack.
Right on. That's cool. I mean, it's like, I'm just trying to take everything as, you know, if, like, there's something that's in there that people like or see, like, I encourage that. I just, you know, I'm happy, like, letting it come up or go down, like, in terms of focus and you know, clarity and detail. And, like, I want it to be able to, like, change pace, you know. Like, in Storyville, there's certain sections where I let it go because I want to speed you up as a reader and slow you down with the detail. And it's really conscious, but I'm trying to make it look offhandish and, you know. Like, some people love it, some people hate it. You know?
I'm just intrigued about Chocolate Gun. It's a noise band?
Yeah, it's a noise band.
That all the kids are into?
Yeah, it's a noise band that, like, it's Castle's favorite band. It's like, but it's everybody's favorite band. So whether you're a jock or a, you know, or a goth or whatever, like, everybody loves Chocolate Gun. And, you know, the references are obviously there to, you know, certain bands or whatever, but it's like a noise band, but then you never, that's the beauty of comics or whatever, you never get to hear it or see it. But the, like, the Wipers references is my way of referencing Cobain, because, like, Cobain covered it, and, you know, like, the Melvins covered it. A bunch of people have covered that song. It's a great, you know, Pacific Northwest song or whatever.
Are you a fan of noise yourself? Noise?
For the most part, yeah, but it's not like I don't live in Providence or anything, but, I mean, Lightning Bolt is definitely one of the greatest bands I've ever seen. So is Kites, and, you know, I love it, but that was Ben's. I remember when Ben, when he said, like, of the noise band, I just laughed. Like, I just thought that was perfect. It felt so today, you know. So,
well, I'm a fan of noise. So,
right on.
My first concert was the Melvins.
Nice. The Melvins lived in San Francisco in the early '90s, and they were working at Round Table Pizza on Geary Boulevard, and I bought T-shirts from them.
Awesome.
That's not noise.
You haven't listened to the Melvins then.
I've heard some.
I remember the last time I saw them, it was like, part of the show you're all going to love, and there's parts that you all hate. And it's like, you know, so they did two sets. The first half was like kind of poppy, whatever, and then the second half started with just like white noise. Oh, and this
nice.
Guy had
did
this
you,
like...
Have you seen them with the two drummers?
No.
Oh my God, I've heard it's amazing.
Well, the one drummer by himself is pretty deadly,
yeah.
So...
Yeah. Dale is incredible. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, and then Pittsburgh has Don Cavalero's from here. I went to high school with the drummer from Don Cavalero, and he's a pretty great guy, and Ian is in Battles now. So, I mean, there's, like, I'm aware of all that, you know, stuff is going on, but it's, like, that was, like, when he made up Chocolate Gun, it was, like, I think he was referencing, you know, Cobain on one hand, and then, you know, just, like, Providence on another hand, but mm-hmm. Pittsburgh at the same time.
Well, our guest last week was Brian Ralph, so...
Oh, right on. Yeah, that was a great interview. He's amazing. He's turned on. I mean, they've known about it, but the kids that he teaches are like the most amazing kids you've ever seen. The closed caption crew. Like, they showed up to SBX and just ruled it. It was incredible. Those kids are great.
Well, I hope I can make. I've only been to SBX once. I went not the most recent one, but I went last year, and I'm hoping I can.
Yeah, you'll like it.
I loved it. I probably spent about $600.
I was there.
It didn't help buying the box of Ivan Brunetti artwork.
Oh my god!
I was there in 1998.
Nice.
Yeah.
Old school. Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's nice because it's just, I don't know, it's the same people you see at every other convention, but it's there's a different vibe to it. And then TCAF is really great. I don't know if you guys have ever get a chance to go check that out.
The Toronto Comic Art Festival.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'd never been to it before, and it's remarkable.
Yeah,
I really must say.
It looked great. Like, they had just everyone there. You know, like a whole panel with Joe, Matt, and Seth, and Chester, and a whole bunch
fantastic.
Of different stuff.
And,
yeah.
And then it was, and the vibe was really nice, too, because it was, and for I think for everybody that did the show who was at San Diego, which was right before it, it was a perfect antidote, you know. And like Darwin Cook's walking around. It's just funny.
Oh, Darwin.
Right.
Now, we're getting close to the end of our, well, not close, we got 10 minutes, about 10, 15 minutes left. So I want to kind of jump into your writing for Comics Comics Mag.
Oh, right on.
And Comics Comics Blog,
mm-hmm.
Or comiccomicsmag.blogspot.com. And you could also check out Picturebox, is it Picturebox.com or is it
Picturebox.com?
There we go. Now, you're kind of, it's neat, you're kind of, I guess, exploring some of your early tastes.
Yeah.
With what you're writing about?
I think so. Yeah, in the last Comics paper issue, I wrote about Ronin by Frank Miller, and that was a great comic. And it was a seminal comic for a lot of reasons, for the direct market and everything. Kevin Nolan, the mm-hmm. artist, did a great, you know, I talked to him about color and things, and I wrote about that in Comics 2. You know, I'm just trying to, like, I think a lot of alternative cartoonists, like, dismiss a lot of, you know, older mainstream stuff. And I also think that, for the most part, history begins for them with Chester Brown or the early 90s or something. Like, you know, there's not a lot of, like, people aren't really looking at, like, the late 80s and what became, you know, the 90s. And I think a lot of the stuff that really still influences me is stuff from that time. And I find myself, like, rereading Electra Assassin or something like that and thinking it's great, you know. Mm-hmm. And I sort of just want to share that because I don't think it's pretentious or weird or anything. I just kind of want to share that, like, my enthusiasm for those projects.
Well, I got to be honest. Like, I love seeing an article about Kevin Nolan because, to me, like, my roots, I'll be honest, they're superhero. I got my superhero comics. I love
right
them.
On.
You know, we all can't be Raw kids, Colin, you know.
I was reading comics before Raw.
Yeah, sorry, Tintin. Does anyone even like Tintin?
Asterix.
I liked Asterix. I don't like Tintin. But so, yeah, Kevin Nolan is one of those guys that really, like, stands out because it's such a different style comparatively with everything else. But meanwhile, he's steeped right into the middle of the superhero genre.
Yeah.
So what was it to him that made you want to, like, focus on doing an article about his coloring?
Well, he did a great, I mean, like, one of my favorite comics of all time is Outsiders Annual number 1. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it's a Batman comics, Outsiders Annual 1, and there was a new coloring process that had happened in the 80s, and he was really the first person to master it. And he just nailed this comic in terms of the color, and it was all hand separations. And, you know, we spoke about it, and he told me, and I wrote this article, and I just felt like, you know, these things are kind of overlooked in comics history. Like, everything's the same for 100 years, and then it changes, whether it's Photoshop or whatever. And then there's people around who don't even remember the stories anymore of the way things are used to color. They talk about it, but they forget. And I wanted to just write about that and explore that, because that's what I'm dealing with right now. Is like, you know, I learned the hard way that printers do not want camera-ready originals anymore. They want PDFs, and, like, I was doing that up until 2005. You could just give the printer your originals, and now they won't take. They want you to give them PDFs. Like, it's over. So, you know, a certain way things were colored is over.
And that's how you color cold heat, though, isn't it? You do the layer.
It's all, if you look on the coldheatcomics.com website, there's a little film that you can see the way cold heat is made. It's like I draw everything on cheap Kinko's 11 by 17 paper, and I just have, like, there's about 8 separations per page, I would say. You know, it's pretty crazy.
A little labor-intensive.
Yeah, John Vermilia, who's a fantastic cartoonist who works for Picturebox doing a lot of production stuff, is the guy putting it together, and he's always cursing me under his breath. But it looks great. You know, we put it together, and, you know, John does a fantastic job of, like, you know, getting it all right, you know, because it still has to be files to the printer.
Now, when can we expect to see the ending of Cold Heat?
This summer.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's gonna. It just needs to get to the printer by a certain date. You know, we're just finishing putting the last touches on it and everything, and should be the summer of this year. And I'm pretty excited. I'm nervous because, like, there's something about the pamphlet that's, like, just cool. It gets out there.
Yeah.
You know, but the graphic novel, it's like it's a commitment. You know, and, like, I liked issue 4. You know, or something. I didn't like the other issues, but issue 4 was good. But with the graphic novel, like, you know, it's got to be really good so people are going to shell out $20 or whatever.
What else do you have coming out?
I'm really just focusing on Cold Heat right now. I have these ideas about these other projects and maybe doing these, like parallel universe Cold Heat things, like sort of like different artists with their take on Cold Heat, but not just doing a pinup, like people who are actually really interested in the material, like John Vermilia. Mm-hmm. Did a fantastic Cold Heat special.
Tracking down a copy, but the comic store that I get my odd stuff through is still sitting and waiting
right,
to get that.
Right. So it's great. And a friend of mine, Chris Cornwell, did one that's really awesome. And just the idea of, like, instead of just doing pinups, you know, everybody does a pinup or something in the back. Like, I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to, you know, let them riff on Cold Heat and maybe bring in, like, you know, it's just. I think it's an idea, and Ben loved it. You know, like, we talked about it, but then it was kind of something that I just did with John on my own, and then Ben just loved it so much that, you know, we might do some other things.
And you wrote that one.
Laid it out. But really, it was just, like, I bookended it with layouts, and then I told John just to go nuts and do his thing. It's all John. It's fantastic, you know.
Well, I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
And we'll see more articles at Comics Mag.
Blogspot. Yeah, it's great. It's fun. So I'm glad you guys. I mean, it's great to get response about that. It's fun to engage the comics audience in a different way than just the work.
Yeah. Oh, totally. One of the articles I really liked. I think you wrote the one about the studio book.
Oh, right on. You like that? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I love that stuff. Like, you know, it's, you look back and yeah, it's a little cheesy. You know, a little bit of the Dungeons and Dragons esque warriors and stuff, but. You know.
But it still has a place in your heart.
So. Oh, yeah. I've got,
yeah, totally.
I've got this wonderful, crappy old issue of Wonder Woman with a Jeff Jones cover.
Oh, man, I know. It's awesome. I love that. Yeah.
You know the one I'm talking about where she's, like, chained to the walls?
Yeah. That's the funniest thing is, like, Dan, you know, Dan and Tim, like, just sort of, we sort of all make fun of each other, like, the esoteric knowledge of comics that we have, but, yeah. Like, you know, but it's pretty great. Like, between the three of us, I think we get a nice, different mix. You know, Tim's a great writer and Dan, you know, really has the chops, and but he's just so busy with all these other things that I think, you know, we're trying to get the next issue out.
I was just wondering, comics, it's a newspaper printing, and I was wondering why you chose to do that instead of just going for the website thing like everybody else does these days.
We just wanted it to be like a zine at first. I think we had this idea that we were going to do something like Arthur Magazine before. It's in a different incarnation now, but, you know, originally Arthur, it was, you know, we just thought it could be in comic stores and be free and then, you know, have ads. And then, of course, like, nobody takes any ads out. And then, you know, we just wanted to still be in print, you know, and then we liked the idea of maybe having, we found this printer and you could do these large things, and we got Justin Green to do something, Mark Bell did, so you can have this giant page and somebody can do stuff, so it's an
totally.
Extra bonus, you know.
Without having to shell out the however much that next Kramer's Ergot's going to cost.
Right.
To see a big piece.
Or the comic art. I mean, I love those things, but, you know, and it's we just try to balance it out. We have a lot of nice high-end, you know, things, and then there's like, you know, just like a $3, you know, you'd be surprised how many people just come up to the table, they look at everything, and then they buy comics.
Yeah. Well, I just love the fact that you guys had the Sammy Harkham interviewing Guy Davis.
I know, that was Sammy, but that's cool, right? Because it like ties in with Kevin Nolan and this other, you know,
all these,
to
like,
cover all the bases.
These great pseudo-mainstream guys that just kind of really, like, they're so interesting and inspiring to look at their stuff that they don't get the justice deserved because they're so odd for the mainstream crowd that the...
Absolutely. The same kind of critical attention, you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So it's fun. I mean, you know, we all read this stuff, and I think it's just kind of... I'm just trying to acknowledge that, at least for me, like, you know, we're not trying to take some arty slant on things. It's more like a genuine, this is what we like, you know, and we're just trying to talk about it without being, you know, I don't know, too, you know, self-conscious about it or something. So, fun.
And that's what comics should be.
They should.
Fun. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us today, Frank.
Man, this is awesome. Thank you.
It's it was a swell hour.
All right.
Good time.
Is the rap show next?
The rap... You listened last week, Ryan Ruff, yeah.
Can you play the Ciccone Youth then?
Oh, I will. No, I'm going to... Yeah, don't worry.
We haven't actually seen the rap guys yet, but...
Last time we actually got in trouble because they were here. They just were waiting us to finish.
Did I hear
finish.
You say that you, the only time you went to New York was like 9/11 or something?
No, I went to New York last year before SPX.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it was good times.
That's cool.
Yeah, I did a lot of drinking and got to hang out with Jamie Gillis. If you don't know who he is, Google him. It's he's kind of from the pantheon of you know, John Holmes and Ron Jeremy.
Serious, nice.
It was good times. So thank you very much, Frank. Oh yeah,
thank
there's
you very
the
much,
boys.
Robin. And thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you.
Look forward to more goodness.
All right.
Okay.
Great show.
Okay.
Bye.
That was Frank Santoro. Check out his stuff at comicsmag.blogspot.com. Cold Heat. I think it's Cold Heat Comics or coldheat.com. Just search him. And of course, inkstuds.com. I'll have links to all his stuff. I guess I'm going to end the show with the Ciccone Youth Tough Titty Rap. And then a little Iggy while these guys get set up. And, yeah, next week, Jonathan Dalton. And keep listening. Colin, thank you. He stepped away from the mic. He just gave me a thumbs up. You're useless, Colin. You're useless.
Poo-poo.
Poo-poo.